Well, we're coming to an extremely dense portion of Scripture, probably the most prophetically condensed, as Dr. Pentecost says, in the whole book of Daniel, the 11th chapter, and all of you said, woohoo! Like, you know, can we slow down anymore or get any more dense? But just filled full of prophecies. And you remember we've said that this is one panoramic prophetic vision concerning Daniel's people. In chapter 10, began with Daniel mourning and praying and fasting for 21 days, seeking an answer to a problem. What was that problem? What was he so upset about?
They stopped building the temple.
They had returned to the promised land a couple of years earlier. They had set the foundation stone, offered up some sacrifices, and then went to work building their own businesses and homes and did not build on the temple. So Daniel was extremely upset and wanted to know, what's up with this? You said you'd restore us to the land after the 70 years. You've done that. You're faithful. But why is the temple not being built for your glory? Remember, Daniel lived for who? Daniel? He lived for the glory of the Lord, didn't he? From his teenage, from when we're introduced to him in chapter 1 as a young teenager in captivity, he had set his mind, his heart, he determined that he would not do anything that would defile his God, and he lived his life that way. Wouldn't that be refreshing if our churches were filled with people that would do that, including you and I, if we would be committed to live our lives for his glory, to be taken advantage of, run over, banged into for his glory. It would be a different world, that's for sure. And so now we're in the 10th chapter. He's 85, 87, 83. Different commentators put a different age on him. But he's an elderly man. He's been the head of, right-hand man of the kings of these kingdoms of Babylon and Persia. He's been around a while. And now he's come to this point in the book where he, as an old man, he didn't return with the captives that were restored. But he wants to know, why is the temple not being built? So he's been pouring his heart out before God. Either the Lord himself in verses 4 to 9 showed up, the Lord Jesus Christ showed up in all of his glory and strengthening him. He passed out, and then an angelic messenger is there with him. And then he starts taking him through the vision that he himself had seen and understood. You remember that back in 10... Ten one, isn't it? Daniel himself understood the message. It was true. It was one of great conflict. He understood the message and had an understanding of the vision. So he had somewhat of an understanding of it, and it seems like his understanding is, well, I need some help understanding this. I don't know. But he has an understanding of it. I don't think he fits all the pieces in, because none of the prophets ever could. They couldn't perceive the first coming and then 2,000 years so far and then the second coming. But he wanted to know what's going to happen with the Jewish people. And so he got a near vision, didn't he, of what was going to happen with Alexander the Great coming in and conquering. And that's whose empire, the maps, and we'll be spending probably this morning and part of next week on this, depending on how slow we go, to try to unravel this 11th chapter is so dense, just filled with prophecies concerning primarily two of Alexander's generals. Remember, Alexander takes over the whole known world in like 5 years, and then following Alexander's death in 323, there's a period of between 10 and 15, some say 20, 10 to 20 years where no one's really in control. His four generals are fighting for control. And then the four generals finally come to some agreement, and Ptolemy, it seems, is one of the first. He goes down to Egypt and claims himself king down there. So Ptolemy takes Egypt. We'll talk about this. The four generals divide up Alexander's empire, and your little map there will show you that. We'll talk more about it. And this map up here shows it real well, the dividing up of the empire. And then what is real crucial, what the chapter is very concerned with, is this struggle between General Seleucid and the Seleucid dynasty that is in Syria, Babylon. They take Babylon, Persia, half of Asia Minor. But the real concentration is Syria, right above Israel. right to the north. They are the northern kingdom. And then the southern kingdom is Ptolemy down in Egypt. And so what the 11th chapter is primarily concerned with is this seesaw struggle between these two generals. And then it's going to highlight and come down to Antiochus Epiphanes, and he will be the northern king that comes in, and he is the type of, who do you think? Who have we already seen in some of the earlier chapters? Who is Antiochus Epiphanes represent?
The Antichrist.
And he will be a foreshadowing of the Antichrist and many of the things he will do when he comes. And so it's going to focus down on him, and then it's going to go from him to the end of the chapter, chapter 11, from 36 to 45. It'll be on that future Antichrist, the future ruler. All of this concerning the people of Israel. Daniel wants to know what's going on. Why aren't we restored? When are you coming? When will all the promises be realized? And so he's given this vision. Here's what's going to happen a couple hundred years from now. Greece is going to rise to power and become the mighty power. And Alexander, this young king, in 10 years from the time he starts till the time he dies, takes over the whole known world of his day. And now let me show you what's going to happen. Following Alexander, his kingdom will be divided amongst his four generals. And now the two we want to concentrate on concerning your people, Daniel, that you're asking about, is the kings of the north and the kings of the south, their dynasties, and this battle back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And the thing that is so amazing about this is the exact nature of the prophecies given, they were all fulfilled exactly. But it's very condensed. Verse by verse, you're jumping from ruler to ruler, and back and forth, back and forth. And so some people don't even want to read it. It gives you a headache trying to figure it out. So we'll all get a headache together this morning and just start working down here through it and see what we can discover about this. Everybody with me so far? The 11th chapter gets pretty deep, doesn't it? Remember, keep in mind, 10, 11, and 12 are all one panoramic vision concerning Daniel's people. And as Dr. Pentecost says, that this vision in chapter 11 contains, from 11:2 up through 12:4, contains the most detailed prophetic revelation in the book of Daniel. It's been pretty detailed before, hasn't it? How about chapter 2? How about chapter 7? Chapter 8? It's been pretty detailed, but nothing like what we're about to come up against now in this 11th chapter. And in chapter 11, verse 1 really ends chapter 10 the way they have it divided in our Bibles. And in the first year of Darius the Mede, I arose to be an encouragement and a protection to him. The question is, who is I referring to? It's the angelic messenger that we believe that's been explaining things to him. Some take it as the angelic messenger that was introduced in verse 10 of chapter 10. Others take it to be referring right back to Michael the prince, who had come to help and do battle against the prince of Persia. But it seems best it's the angelic messenger, probably Gabriel. We aren't sure. But this one showed up, and he was there to encourage Darius the Mede. Darius the Mede is who? Have we suggested before? Just another name for who? Well, you're all going to flunk your quiz. How about Cyrus? Cyrus, king of Persia. This is either an appointee of Cyrus that's over Babylon or another name for Cyrus himself. So in the first year of Cyrus in 539 BC, it seems like this angelic messenger was encouraging him in some way. Do you remember Cyrus? What can you tell me about Cyrus from the book of Isaiah? Do you remember our studies in Isaiah? We were in it for months and months and months, so you might not remember. Isaiah chapter 45, do you remember?
Didn't he open the coffers just to pay for the restoration?
He did, but in Isaiah 45, it's prophesied 175 years before he ever comes on the scene that God would raise up his anointed one named Cyrus, who would restore the Jews who hadn't even been taken into captivity yet. Amazing prophecy back way back there in Isaiah. Do you think Daniel had these different prophecies and can see how God was so faithful? And here he is now under Cyrus's rule. Cyrus took over Babylon just as God had prophesied. And so that's pretty exciting. I think Daniel was always amazed at these prophecies. Think how many came to fulfillment in his day, and then how many more he wrote concerning his day and forward, concerning the kingdoms, concerning the Gentile program, what God would allow the Gentile nations of the world to do to discipline his people Israel. Remember, this whole book is all concerning the sovereignty of God, his plan and program, and how he uses the nations and uses all things to accomplish his purposes with his people. And that's where we are here in 11. And somehow, we already, last week we ended by talking about that angelic battle that goes on around all of us and around all cities. And I think it goes around on around us personally. Well, around here it does. I hear lots of people blaming the devil for everything around here. I just like to go look in the mirror and blame myself once in a while. But it is a good escape to blame the devil. Well, this book's all about God's sovereignty and how he is in control. He is prophesying the future. He controls the future. And again, how this angel, if this was Gabriel, the same one that's speaking, he's not named, so we don't know it's Gabriel for sure, but Gabriel's the one that earlier had showed up and spent time with him and explained things to him. But whoever it is, this angelic watcher gave him encouragement and to be a protection to him. So it helped bring him to the throne according to prophecy, just as God had said. He was created because God said he would come along. And as Richard pointed out, even though he had been prophesied 175 years before he ever came, that he was God's man in the sense God said, he's my anointed, he will perform my will, and yet he doesn't know me. That's an amazing thing. So even if men don't want to acknowledge him, he's still sovereign and going to have his way. And this is a classic example here. I have a note in my Bible, and I've never added this up, and so I puzzled over the note, and I read through my commentaries this week trying to find out where I got this. But verses 1 to 35 here contain 135 prophetic statements, every one of which have been fulfilled exactly as they were written. And I don't...
Say that again, Richard.
Verses 1 to 35, we're talking about how dense this section of prophecy is. Verses 1 to 35... contain 135 prophetic statements, all of which have been fulfilled exactly as they were written. They've been fulfilled in history, verses 1 to 35 that we're looking at here this morning. And I must have got that from one of my professors at Dallas, and I don't know which one, and I don't know where they got it, because I haven't found it in the commentaries I've been looking for. And I didn't take the time this week to go through and add every one of them up. Even in that, there would be no agreement, because some would say, well, this is a dual prophecy. Others would say, no, this is one prophecy. But in other words, there's lots of prophecies in here, and they've all been fulfilled literally. And there's a number of historians that record, extra-biblical, that record this period of ancient history, and they record the same things. They match these prophetic statements. They happened. Prophecies concerning the nations, and who was in charge at this time? Persia. Cyrus, Darius the Mede, was in charge of Persia. Verse 2, he's going to tell him, prophesy concerning Persia. In verse 2, I tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings are going to arise in Persia. Then a fourth will gain far more riches than all of them. And as soon as he becomes strong through his riches, he will arouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece. So he says that from Cyrus forward, there will be three kings coming in succession, and then there will be a fourth who will be more powerful than those three, and he's going to pull together the whole Persian Empire and go against Greece. He's going to push westward expansion and go against Greece. These three are, Cyrus, of course, was in charge. Then we had, next comes Cambyses, and the Cyrus's son in 530, Pseudo-Smerdis in 522, and then Darius the First. Oh, another Darius. Darius the First in 521 to 486, and then the one that we read about in the book of Esther, the fourth king who has the most power and for whatever reason goes against Greece. He wants westward expansion, nowhere else to go. So he heads west and goes against Greece, and he ends up being defeated, and that's Xerxes. Xerxes is the fourth, and he's named, called Ahasuerus in the book of Esther, and he's from 485 to 465. And he went against Greece and was soundly defeated, and that's the four kings that are mentioned here. And he turns the whole empire against the realm of Greece and is beat back. And there's lots of history on all of these kings that you can read. It's not included here in this little prophetic, four kings are coming. All right, now let's move on. Let me tell you the next thing that's going to happen. Well, there is so much packed into that second verse with each of these kings and what they did and who rose up and murdered who. And but those are in the history books that can be studied. And a really good commentary I found this week. Do you have Archer on Daniel? Yeah, Archer's one of the best. It's I found it on e-books. I haven't been able to figure out how to break in and swipe it yet. Might have to buy it. A lot of the references, Dr. Pentecost, Dr. Constable, a lot of the professors that I studied Daniel with at Dallas Seminary, they all refer back to Archer. So that is something I may pursue because they all quote Archer heavily. And he, especially on this 11th chapter, has a lot of history. He's gone back and got the four or five historians of this period and after who wrote about this period and these events, and he's pulled them together and he quotes them. So that would be a good one if you're serious about Daniel, would be Archer. So now concerning Greece, verses 3 to 4, and a mighty king will arise. After these four Persian kings, there's going to be a mighty king that will arise, and he will rule with great authority and do as he pleases. But as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out toward the four points of the compass, though not of his own descendants, nor according to his authority which he wielded, for his sovereignty will be uprooted and given to others beside him. The key to the four generals are the four points of the compass there, and then, of course, history. How many mighty generals did Alexander have that served him and kept charge over his different troops that moved with him? There were four of them. And the four generals of Alexander were Cassandra, Lysimachus, Seleucus, and Ptolemy. Those are the four generals that are on your handout there, point C. Parceling out of his kingdom. Well, first of all, the mighty king is Alexander the Great. He is the mighty king, the king of Greece, that took Greece and brought the loose federation of Greek states. He brought them together under his rule, and with lightning speed, he would move and just flat get it done. You'd hear that Alexander was coming. You'd wake up in the morning and he'd conquered you. And he would come in. First thing he would try to do is make peace with you. If you would make peace with him, he would assimilate you into the Greek Empire. His vision was that he needed to Hellenize, give Greek culture, Greek speech to the whole known world. What do you think God's purpose was in that? What was the language, the common language of the day when Jesus was born? What is the New Testament written in? What do you think about that? Greek. Greek. Do you think that would facilitate the copying and the spread of the gospel around the known world of that day? Yes. So God brought Alexander in. God raised him up. God had him conquer the whole known world of his day for his purposes. Look what he did. This is the known world of that day. Alexander, starting over there, up here, where the red is here. This is Greece up here, the Greek peninsula. All of this in Alexander's day would have pulled all these states together, up in here. And then he started heading this way. And part of that was in response to Ahasuerus coming west to do combat with him and conquer him. Well, he soundly defeated them. A million-man army, he defeated them and beat them up in two or three different campaigns and decimated them. He started driving them back to the east and eventually took them out and destroyed them because of God's sovereignty. God said the whole world will be Hellenized. So Alexander, what he wanted to do as a very young man, he took over for his father, Philip of Macedonia. He pulled all these loose states. They're all fighting, kind of like Europe today, or kind of like the United States today. Every senator wants his own earmarks. They want their own share of the pie to take back home. And I was watching a report on that last night. Just makes me want to throw up. They're all up there fighting, and they all want millions and millions of dollars for their little pet projects. And once you hear what those pet projects are, it would just make you throw up. Gay and lesbian actions, fairs, museums, to everything imaginable. Billions of taxpayer dollars thrown away every year. Just makes me sick. Well, that's what Alexander was contending with when he took over, when his father got sick and eventually died. Alexander came in, took over, united the kingdom, and he moved out and began his conquest and took over everything. He is the mighty king. And from 336, but really 334 is when most historians would agree, 334 down to 323, Alexander conquered the ancient world. And the primary conquest was 334 to 330. In only 5 years, he conquered the known world. Quite a feat. And then Alexander died in 323. And so from 323 down to about 304, 310, 304, different historians will give you different dates. 10 to 20 years, his four generals were fighting over his kingdom. And then they finally came to somewhat of an agreement. When Ptolemy came down and took Egypt in green, you see Egypt there, that was his general Ptolemy. And that became the Ptolemy dynasty that reigned in Egypt for the next several hundred years, or a couple hundred years. And then Israel is that thin corridor going north and south. And then above Israel, you see all of that in orange? That is the Syrian. That is Seleucid that took everything up in the north. He took Syria, eastern provinces of Asia, Babylon, Persia. But what he was primarily concentrated in was Babylon and coming down, always wanting to take over Egypt. He wanted Egypt. And Egypt then, they wanted what he had. So these two are going to be the major focus of fighting north and south. The king of the north, the king of the south. The king of the north, the king of the south, as you read through here. And as you read through that, from verse to verse, as you're going back and forth, one's dying and a new one's coming up. And so just heavily packed in as we go to work down through these verses. And then off back over the yellow in Macedonia, that's Greece. And back over there is Cassander. Cassander takes over Greece. And actually, the yellow and all to the north of the yellow, he takes over all of that. But he's primarily focused on Greece, the ancient city. That's Cassander. He ruled Macedonia and Greece. And some of the western parts, that yellow shows Seleucid coming all the way over this orange. I'm sorry, the orange. It shows Seleucid coming all the way over. But actually what they say, there was even a little scrapping going on over there where Cassander had parts of Western Asia Minor. But you see they're fighting east and west, but that's not really highlighted all that much here. Everybody's always fighting for territory, aren't they? You need more territory to pay more taxes so you can buy more stuff. And so they've been doing that for hundreds of years, thousands of years, and nothing new. And then you have Lysimachus. He took Thrace in Asia Minor, but he's not talked about that much. So it seems like he got himself a little piece of the pie, and he's kind of happy and just held on to that. But the two that become the primary focus, again, are north and south. Egypt, the Ptolemies, and then the guys in the orange are the Seleucids. And so as you read down through here, you can refer to your map. And Israel, poor little Israel, is the buffer zone in between. And they fight back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, until we come down to Antiochus Epiphanes, who's like the fourth or fifth Syrian ruler of the Seleucid dynasty. And he becomes the type of Antichrist that we'll look at here. So any questions on Persia or Greece? And again, there are volumes written on this. As Larry says, Robert Dick Wilson, he'll spend 40, 50 pages on verse 2, talking about all of this history. If that's something that interests you, it's packed full of what took place. And extra biblical, again, do we need the extra biblical historians to validate our faith? No, but it sure is nice to read them and see where they go right along with the Bible. What do you say? What if there's a discrepancy somewhere? What do you do with that?
Bigger history was wrong.
That's right. Stick with your Bible, boys. I had a professor way back at Biola College who used to say, give the old book some time. Even if it's not proven to us now, it will be eventually.
Just spend a lifetime running those
give it some time.
Those rabbit trails.
That's right. Egypt and Syria, verses 5 to 20. So you understand here in verse 4 that as soon as he is arisen, 5 years he took everything, Alexander the Great, as a young man. But as soon as he took all of this, he ends up pushed all the way over Persia, all the way over to Mongolia, to the mountains of Mongolia, and he saw those, and he even tried to push up into there. And his troops are just exhausted from this 5-6 year campaign. And so he finally, it was cold, freezing cold, trying to get up in those Mongolian, get through the Himalayans. So he finally said, forget this. I don't know, maybe his generals told him, hey, boss, we got enough to hold on to here. Why don't we go back and enjoy the fruits of what you've conquered? Okay, so they went back to Babylon, was the palace where he took over the Babylonian palace, and then just started drinking and partying, and he had caught malaria, apparently, and he died there in Babylon. And before he died, this is why his men followed him and why he could move them so quickly. And they accomplished unbelievable feats for him. He said, take me to my men. He's dying. They took him out and propped him up. And he had his men march by. And as weak as he could, he tried to salute them as his troops all marched by, rank by rank, rank by rank. That's why they love this guy. A little bit crazy. But
you'd have that duck walk thing or whatever.
They might have. I don't know if they're doing a duck walk, but
most of them do. Yeah.
I think you mean goose step.
Goose step or whatever that
yeah,
is.
Yeah, goose step.
It all looks alike to me. It's got to be a killer on your troops.
I was watching Iran last night on the news. You see them guys, man. That's got to be hard on the back, boy.
Yeah,
what do you think, Howard? Slamming down like that.
My old fight when they get there.
Man, my old back's just screaming when I watch them guys just march through the parade ground there. Well, just I don't know about you, but I love reading that history of Alexander the Great and where he came down. When he came down through here, this is Tyre right here. You remember that story when he came to Tyre, the ancient city of Tyre? Nebuchadnezzar tried to conquer the mainland city. It took him several years to break through, and by the time he broke through, nobody was home except some slaves and servants. And where's all the gold? Where's all the people? Well, they snuck out at nights over there. They're over there on the island out there. And so it says Nebuchadnezzar, God paid him well, and there was no money left. It said that they rubbed their heads bald and their shoulders bare from carrying the siege works and the rocks to break into that mainland city. His troops were worn out, and they didn't get any pay once they got in. Mutiny. And God there in Isaiah says, turn now and go down to Egypt, and I will pay you for your services to me. And taken out Tyre. So he never did get Tyre. Well, who came through several years later? Alexander the Great. Where's the city now? They're out there on the island. When Alexander showed up, they heard he was coming. They're all out there just drinking Greek coladas. Pinas, they're called, I guess, today. Well, they're all, and what are they doing when Alexander's there looking in his telescope, and they're up there on the walls mooning him? So Alexander says, just set up camp here, boys, and bring the architects and the engineers. Get Howard Watts and Tom Treat up here. Boys, I want to take that city. What do we need to do? And you already knew you had to have an answer real quick. Well, King, we got all this rubble from the ancient city. Why don't we build a causeway out there and just march out there and get them? I like that. Okay, boys, go to work. Built a causeway, went out there and destroyed them and took everything. God said that he would do it. Amazing prophecies. He came on down through, took Egypt, swung back around, came up to Jerusalem to see what's up with that. And the high priest came out, opened the scriptures, and showed him where it was all written that he would do exactly what he had done. He said, I like that. He said, I need some of your religious boys to go with me. Does anybody want to go with me on my travels? We're going east. We're going to take Babylon. We're going to take Persia. We're going to take the world. You got some boys want to go with me? Yeah, you bet. So they signed up some priests, and the high priest blessed Alexander, and Alexander blessed him with a bunch of money and didn't destroy nothing and took off. Fabulous. So I like reading that stuff myself.
Can you imagine, just a little sidebar here, you'd over on Bee Creek Road near Chuck's house, they're building that new Walmart, and they've been over there breaking up and spreading old
yes.
rocks around for 6 months, just getting that pad ready for Walmart to go in. Just imagine the amount of effort it took to push all that rock
into the sea.
Into the sea and build that causeway.
And all slave labor.
Yeah,
sure did. Wore them bald and their shoulders bare.
That didn't have caterpillars back then, yeah.
That was the caterpillars. 140 pounds and
some of them dead bones out there that them guys walked on.
You better believe it. Yeah, that's a great picture.
Push you off in there and help you fill up.
Where they come in, they're coming in there and they've got dynamite. They're dynamiting those mountains, and they've got those backhoes and those mules to carry all that. Just think how they did all this, all manual labor, and how they built these war catapults, these war engines for warfare. When you go to Israel at Masada, they have some of the ancient catapults and stuff that they found pieces of them and rebuilt them for a movie. But they got them as exact as they think they could. But they are so cool standing next to one of these things that would sling rocks up to inside there to get them. Early first cannons built by the Romans. And before them, the Assyrians and others, Babylonians, the Assyrians, as far back, these weapons of warfare. And it took thousands of men to even build them and move them, and get those things loaded. Just great stuff. And so after he died, but as soon as he is arisen, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out toward the four points of the compass. There's his four generals. His four generals, each of them got a piece of that. And something that it never hit me until Dr. Honer, I had studied this with Dr. Pentecost, and it never really hit me till Dr. Harold Honer, who was the head of the New Testament department and head of PhD studies, he has done his own study of Daniel and written his own commentaries on it, and he has done detailed study of chapter 11. And it never dawned on me that where it talks about here that Alexander died, in this one verse, Alexander died and his kingdom was parceled out. Well, how long do you think that, would you normally think reading that verse, that just happened, right? He died and four guys arose and got the kingdom, right? Well, Harold Honer emphasized, no, it was close to 20 years before that, those four generals divided up the empire. And just the way he presented it, it had never really hit me before that. And so many times we read a verse and we think, well, this just happened. This is the next successive chronological event. This happened and then this just happened. No, there's years in between. And you have to start to see that and think that way, because Daniel, from Daniel's day now, he's going to go down here through the rest of this chapter, and he's going forward hundreds of years, and then he's going to go forward to add to the final Antichrist thousands of years. And all of that's within a verse or two, and you get to reading that. And if you're not looking for that and alert to that, you don't see it. Remember Isaiah 61:1-2? Isaiah 61:1-2, where Jesus came into the temple that day and they handed him the scroll for the daily reading, and it was set right at what? Isaiah 61, the whole passage. He read the first two verses, rolled it back up and handed it to him and said, this scripture has been fulfilled this day in your hearing. And he sat down. What was the scripture? The Lord has sent me to bring blessing unto you. He's anointed me to bring freedom to the captivities. Why didn't he continue reading? Because from verse 3 of 61 on, all talks about his second coming in power and glory, when he will defeat all of God's enemies on the earth and will establish himself as king and reign and rule. First two verses, he'd come to bring peace, but they didn't want it. And then verses 3 on, so you're going from a prophecy concerning his day to thousands of years in the future. And, oh, do you think he didn't know that? He wrote it. It was his word. So look for that as you read through this. So his kingdom's parceled out towards the four points of the compass, though not according to his own descendants. Both of his sons, Hercules and Alexander's son Hercules and Alexander. The first thing they did was put him to death. The generals did. And also Uncle Philip. Anybody that might be a contender for the throne, his four generals killed them all real quick. And then they went to work fighting over who's going to get what. And some 10, 15 years later, and I imagine the whole time they were all enjoying the fruits of Alexander's conquests. There's plenty there to share. And they finally divided it up and came to some understanding later. So it was parceled out, not according to his descendants, nor according to his authority. He's dead and gone. His four generals eventually wielded his authority, not according to his authority or his sovereignty. It had been uprooted and given to others besides them. So not according to his family, but his four generals. And then Egypt and Syria, 5 through 20, then the king of the south will grow strong along with one of the princes who will gain ascendancy over him and obtain dominion. His dominion will be a great dominion indeed. The king of the south. Who was the king of the south? What general is that? General Ptolemy. So he rose up and he gained strength. He's one of the first ones. I think most historians place it at about 312 or so that he took over. He went down to Egypt and said, I'm going to hold on to this. I like it down here. And he proclaimed himself king around 312 BC. But the others didn't fully recognize that until some years later. So it starts with the king of the south. He goes down to Ptolemy, General Ptolemy goes down and proclaims himself king in 312 is what the historians tell us. And he becomes strong along with one of his princes. And his dominion will be a great dominion indeed. So he takes all of Egypt. Verse 6, after some years, they will form an alliance, and the daughters of the king of the south will come to the king of the north. Who's that? Seleucid. And that's just right up above Israel, up to the north. He comes up to the king of the north to carry out a peaceful arrangement. And what he does is he brings his daughter, and it says she will not retain her position of power, nor will he remain with his power, but she will be given up along with those who brought her in and the one who sired her as well as he who supported her in those times. The daughter of the king of the south, that's Ptolemy's daughter Bernice. Ptolemy's daughter Bernice. He brings her up to the king of the north and marries her off. And as you go back and read the history of this period, his daughter is supposed to do what her dad tells her and help bring defeat to Ptolemy down in the south because he's powerful. And Seleucid wants to take over Egypt in their holdings, so he puts his daughter in there. But what does his daughter do? I think she was only like 13 when he gave her to Seleucid as his wife. What does his daughter do? Does anybody know? Do you think she goes along with the old man, or does she help and just become one with her husband Ptolemy? Her dad's trying to use her to gain control over Ptolemy and eventually defeat him. But as you go back and read history, Bernice doesn't go along with dad's plan. She goes along with Ptolemy and so goes against her dad. And so he never realizes his plans is what's going on here. The king of the north, the daughter of the king of the south will come to the king of the north. So Ptolemy gives his daughter Bernice to Seleucid up in the north to carry out a peaceful arrangement, but she will not retain her position of power, nor will he remain with his power, but she will be given up along with those who brought her in and the one who sired her, as well as he who supported her in those times. So the brothers of Bernice, this all backfires, it doesn't work. And it was to bring about a peaceful arrangement, but according to history, it was more than that. It was to try to take over Ptolemy and take over Egypt, but it doesn't work. And so this begins then, this battle between the kings of the north, the Seleucid dynasty, versus the kings of the south, the Ptolemy dynasty. And they're going to go back and forth through these next verses, fighting, trading off against one another. Ptolemy the Second gave his daughter Bernice in marriage to Antiochus the First, the Seleucid, but Antiochus deserted her and was later murdered. And so this begins this section of the battle between the north and the south. And then in verse 7, but one of the descendants of her line will arise in his place, and he will come against her army and enter the fortress of the king of the north, and he will deal with them and display great strength. One of the descendants of Ptolemy the Third invaded Syria in 246 BC. So we're down now 150, 60 years later, aren't we? So 150, 160 years. Well, we're running through some descendants. Ptolemy the First is gone. Ptolemy the Second's come, and now we got Ptolemy the Third. So this is very condensed history, and you can spend days reading all of this and all the intrigue and who Seleucid the First, Seleucid the Second. And they're fighting back and forth through this whole time. So it's been from 246, we're down to 246 now here in verses 7 to 8. And we went from 312 down to 246. So history's running along, rulers are coming and going. And what's the point? Why are these, the Seleucids up in the north and the Ptolemies down in the south, why are they the ones being mentioned back and forth here? Israel's in the middle. They affect Israel. All of this I'm going to tell you is concerning your people. You're concerned with your people? Let me show you what's going to happen to them.
Still
going on today. Until Messiah comes. It will be, remember he began this vision back in verse 10? I'm going to show you a vision, a panoramic vision, concerning your people. And what you're requesting, peace and Messiah coming, that's far off. It's going to be troublesome times for a long time. And let me show you, starting with this. And so every time these guys are fighting, who do they got to go through to get to one another to fight? Israel. Do you think they're swiping their sheep and goats and wives and daughters and on the way? Yeah, because they've got the military strength. So Israel's just getting beat up through all of this. And as Daniel is understanding this and this angelic messenger is telling him about this, what do you think this is doing to Daniel, whose whole life is to bring God glory and see God's people restored to God, to serve God, and to see them on top with Messiah reigning and ruling? What do you think Daniel's doing as he's getting this explained to him and writing it all down for future generations? Oh, bummer. His heart's got to be broken. And all of this because they refuse to obey God. But God is sovereign, and he's still going to have his way. Verse 8, also their gods with their metal images and their precious vessels of silver and gold he will take into captivity to Egypt, and he on his part will refrain from attacking the king of the north for some years. So it seems like he goes up there with great power and strength in verse 7. This is another Ptolemy, Ptolemy the Third. He goes up there in 246, invades them, takes their idols, their images and idols of gold and silver, and he goes back to Egypt, and then he's happy for a while. He doesn't attack them. Now the north is sitting up there, and the kid or the grandkid comes along and says, where did all our gold and silver idols go? Well, Ptolemy came and took them. Well, that dirty bird. And so he gathers his strength, and where's he go? Back down to Egypt to beat up on him, to get all of his idols of silver and gold back and beat him. So verse 9, then the later will enter the realm of the king of the south. Who's the later? Some of you came in here this morning, I heard some discussions about, well, who in the world is this referring to? And what? And that made me happy because that showed you're reading ahead a little bit. Up late last night, reading ahead. Praise the Lord. Who's the later? Verse 9. Then the later will enter the realm of the king of the south. The Seleucid, the king of the north, who was just being described, who just got beat up. When you get beat up, are you just going to sit back and take it until you're strong enough to beat back, right? That's what's going on through this section. It's what's been going on throughout history. It's what's going on over there today. What do you think ultimately is going to happen to that big mouth up there in Iran?
He's going to go over there and whip on him. He's probably going to start a big mess.
Do you think Israel will let him go that far?
I think no, because I think they'll start this Armageddon thing here pretty quick.
Yeah, I don't know if you guys know it, but Israel has nuclear capability. They have one of they match. In fact, it's probably one of our old nuclear systems. It's in down in the southern in the wilderness, down in the Negev. It's all underground. You know it's there with all the fences that say in Hebrew, English, and Arabic, "Hot, don't touch." And this compound, just you know, I don't know how many acres, how many miles, just miles and miles and miles. But it's just desert wilderness. There's nothing there except guard posts, a couple places where you can get in constant patrols. There's nothing there. It's all underground nuclear facility. They've got capability to wipe Iran off the face of the earth. And that little nut keeps flapping his mouth over there. Israel, we're going to push them into the sea. We now have nuclear. We're pursuing nuclear capabilities. We're like a freight train that cannot be stopped. We have no brakes. Yeah, well, they're going to get broke. Israel's not going to let them come get them. It's going to be interesting to watch. The whole world is pulling back from Israel now. It's a hot potato. And we're even, well, I don't know if we should support Israel. Oh, you dummies. As long as we do, maybe God will be gracious and not thump us and take us out. Because we're way past due, don't you think? Way, way past due. Now, Bush last night announced he's got another summit on the table. He just wants to go back to Israel and eat some more date figs and all that good stuff. Yeah, going to go try to bring them together. Oh, George. Tempest said last night, he claims to be a Christian. Has he ever read this? Is he reading this? And what I said to her, and I don't know, this is Chuck's commentary. Can you imagine the pressure, the world, the global pressure on Bush and other leaders to make them come together? Unbelievable pressure. And what does Israel want? They want to come together. What's it going to cost us to get some peace? We need peace. We need security. They aren't going to get it until who? Back in Daniel chapter 9, 24 to 27, when Antichrist arises, he will have the power and authority and he will give it to them. And they will embrace him as their who? If we could fly over to Israel today on the Concorde, be there in a few hours. I like that. I know they don't fly anymore, but if we could fly over there on that thing and get there, and you go out and ask any Jew on the street, what is it that you're looking for? The man who will bring us peace. He will be our Messiah. Well, he's Antichrist. Well, we don't know nothing of this, or your Western interpretations. We were looking for the man of peace. The Bible describes him as Antichrist.
I never did get it. Still don't.
Nope, they don't get it. They don't get it. Verse 11, the king of the south. So now the king of the north, the king of the north, verse 10, I'm sorry, verse 9, then the latter one, the king of the north, is going to enter the realm of the king of the south, but he will return to his own land, and his sons will mobilize and assemble a multitude of great forces, and one of them will keep on coming and overflow and pass through, that he may again wage war up to this very fortress. So Seleucid now is attacking Ptolemy. Verse 11, and the king of the south, Ptolemy, will be enraged at him and go forth and fight against the king of the north. Then the latter, the king of the north, will raise a great multitude, but that multitude will be given into the hand of the former. When the multitude of it is carried away, his heart will be lifted up and he will cause tens of thousands to fall, yet he will not prevail. So Seleucid comes back. Ptolemy goes against Seleucid. Seleucid comes back against Ptolemy. Ptolemy, back and forth, the seesaw struggle, back and forth, and one gets beaten down, and he licks his wounds and gathers up force, and he goes again. So this is just detailed of what's going on. Daniel has to just be absolutely flabbergasted that all of this is going to happen to Israel, because every time one of these back and forth, verse by verse, you're going from verse to verse, and you're jumping from descendant to descendant to descendant, and this battle's going on and going on and going. Is there anything new in the Middle East? What's going on in Iran every day? You got all these different ethnic groups are all fighting against each other. It's just amazing. Nothing new. And here we see this history.
Do you have, just for grins, where you're talking right here, starting with Darius up here in the first verse of 11, do you have it? How many years down to where you're at right now?
539 down to, we've come through 246, 200, verses 9 to 13 is 223 to 200. in those three verses. Verse 9 to 13 is 223 B.C. down to 200 B.C.
Okay, and so you're from 5, actually from here in
so we're
8 verses, you've gone 300 years?
Yeah. So is that condensed or what? Just think of all the, so you go back and study secular history, extra-biblical history, and they detail this period. We have detailed records. If you want it all condensed and shooken out, go on the website to Robert Dick Wilson. He'll have this all detailed. Walvoord and Zook, Dr. Pentecost, does a thumbnail sketch of it, gives you a brief, but if you want to really dig in, you need Robert Dick Wilson or Archer or one of those others to really dig in, and they will give you the sources of where to go. I think I've got some sources here. I do. If you go back to the Greek historian Polybius, the apocryphal books of 1st and 2nd Maccabees, get yourself a Catholic Bible and read 1st and 2nd Maccabees in the Catholic Bible. Those books were written during this period. Even though we call them extra-biblical, we do not accept them as inspired. They are fabulous for one purpose. What would that be? The history of this time. Detailed. They're wonderful. 1st and 2nd Maccabees. The 1st century writer, Diodorus Siculus. The Roman historian, is it Livy?
Livy.
Josephus, 2nd century A.D. Appian, Porphyry, who quoted from Jerome, who Jerome quoted. So there's a number of histories written during this period that are wonderful. Start with 1st and 2nd Maccabees. Everybody's got a Catholic Bible, don't you?
There's a really good edition of the apocryphal books out from Oxford, and it has, as you open up a page like this, it'll have 8 versions, starting up in the upper left-hand corner with the Greek for those few verses, and then it'll go, say, a New American Standard, or not a New American Standard, but a Revised Standard, and it'll have 8 different versions of each page, each section of notes on it. It's just really a great edition of the apocryphal books, including 1st and 2nd Maccabees, of course, and all the others that are
what
in the Catholic. It's a special edition of the apocryphal books. The ones that you find in a Catholic Bible are separated out and put in a single volume in 8 different versions on each page for the I'll try to remember to bring a copy of it.
Now you know why he wore out both his eyes. But those are great, great study aids. Can you imagine? You know, the thing that amazed me at seminary is like a man like Robert Dick Wilson, these different men of history, just the work that they put in their days. I mean, they just had to be tireless to read all of the stuff out there in their days and then bring it all together and then write, include that in their commentaries. It's absolutely fabulous, just fabulous. But you have to be a reader to appreciate that, and you got to love history. But all of that adds to our knowledge of the scriptures, and I'll stop there. There's alarms going off here, and I'm going to quit while we're ahead.